My name is John R. Mahaffey. I'm the president of Mahaffey Construction Company. My presence here is, and my purpose here is twofold. Number one, I'm opposed to the bill. And number two, it's my understanding that at a prior hearing, two people who purchased homes from me were here stating that they did not have recourse, that they felt their homes were not adequately taken care of, that my firm did not respond, and that they didn't have protection apparently from the FHA. I would like to take them one at a time. Barbara Hansen, who lives in Cedar Crest, in a home I built, started I think something over a year ago. I think she took possession around March 1972. Mrs. Hansen has written us one letter dated May 10th, 1972, wherein she had two complaints. One was that her yard was not graded, and the other that there was some faulty gutter work. The letter was dated May 10th. We were able to take care of the grading on May the 11th. We took care of the gutters on May 12th, 1972. Subsequent to that, on October 5th, Mrs. Hansen asked that I repair her garage door since it would not lock. Now, I don't know if you people are aware of how a garage door locks, but there's a keeper in the garage molding that comes down the middle and a slot, bolt that goes through that. These are adjusted tightly, so the door will not blow or make noise and rattle in the wind. I did send the garage door mechanic out to fix her door. He did fix it. But the reason it wouldn't close is Mrs. Hansen had carpeted her garage. And when she closed the garage door onto the carpet was thick enough so that it would not go into the slot, would not go into the, or the piece of metal would not go into the slot in the garage door by just the thickness of the carpet. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? How you pull a door down and go like so. I had some very slight financial problems with Mrs. Hansen. And she wrote me quite a letter stating what her side was. She signed the letter, and you're welcome to read the letter if you like. She signed the letter, unfortunately, a Mahaffey homeowner. I got this on November the 7th. On November 21st, I responded to Mrs. Hansen, and without going into the other parts of it, which you're welcome to see, I said in the last paragraph, I was personally distressed at the way you signed your letter, unfortunately a Mahaffey homeowner, and I would like to offer several solutions to your dilemma. Number one, our firm will give you a check for your original investment if you would like to sell this property back to us. Two, we will sell your house for the FHA appraisal, providing this appraisal does not exceed the new 235 limits. Our fee for this would be 2% of the selling price. Both of these options are available to you until December 15, 1972. May we hear from you soon. I have never heard from Mrs. Hansen. And so much for her. Mrs. Sunholm had a problem. She stated on the television interview that she had written us two letters with no response, that her bathtub plumbing had not been hooked up, and the county health department stated that dry rot would occur if the water was not drained that was under the house. According to our records, we received no letters from Mrs. Sundholm. She did call on October 3, 1972, and reported the bathtub plumbing was not hooked up and that there was 1 foot of water under the crawl space. She further reported her garage door would not stay down and that she had some grout coming off her bathtub tile. The bathtub was hooked up on October 5th. The garage door was repaired on October 11th. And Canyon Linoleum, who does my tile work, tells me they have repaired the grout around the tub. This is a letter that I wrote November 8th. One of the interesting things about this case is that the very same county health department that told her she was going to have dry rot and so on is the agency that is charged with making a complete plumbing inspection. Among other things, they are required to get on the roof, fill the pipes and the vents with water, make sure that the water stays there, which would prove that there are no leaks before they issue the cover card, which then permits builders to install the wallboard and complete the house. Certainly this happened. It happens probably once every 10 or 15 years. This is the first time it happened to me in 18 years. But by some strange set of circumstances, the county health department did not apparently properly inspect this house. I'm not using them. We don't do this type of thing. We don't get up on the roof and fill the vents and so on. But what I am saying is it was repaired within 1 day from the time we heard about it. And this was not by letter. Any responsible builder will take care of any emergency complaint immediately. Now, with regard to the warranty bill, I'm opposed to it because we have a good many protections for the people and our consumers now. We have our builders board. All they have to do if they feel that they have a complaint is write to the builders board, who will then send out a fact-finding committee to the house. If they find that the builder has to repair it, he must do so. If he does not, is charged against his bond and repaired by others. In addition, we have our FHA and VA housing, which normally would constitute in Oregon some 50 to 60%, at least in the Portland market, of the houses built. I understand that you've been told that the FHA inspections are superficial and that the VA inspections are superficial and don't mean much. Any one of you who would like to look at these two files can read all the inspections that we get, and they are not superficial. The FHA and the VA are well aware of consumerism. They're well aware of what they have to do to protect the people and protect their customers, because they are their customers. To impose another warranty besides the builders board, besides the FHA, besides the VA and so on, and besides the Attorney General's office. They have a consumer department. People can complain to them, and they will force the builder to, if he is in error, to take care of it. As far as the length of warranty, this is something that our National Association is considering. We're considering an insurance policy for 10 years wherein builders will buy the policy from the National Association. The builder will take care of the complaints the first 2 years. The insurance company will take care of it the next 8. These would be latent defects and so on. This is a system that's been operating for about 10 years in England. The Canadians are looking at it. The New Zealand people have it. Australia is looking at it and so on. Our industry is not hiding in the bushes. We have to do what's right. But I don't think that we need additional laws when certainly the home buyer today has adequate recourse. I thank you.
Questions of Mr. McAfee?
I'd like to ask an insurance.
Senator White.
You spoke about a bond, and is there a Department of Commerce that has to do with builder's business?
Yes, sir.
Yes?
The Department of Commerce, by a law that went into effect, I think a year ago last July, requires that every person who builds a house for sale has to have a builder's bond before he can get a permit to build it. In addition to that, if you as a citizen were to hire someone to put a roof on your home who did not have a builder's bond, you don't have to pay him.
Well,
you know the what? You know the one. The bond is in effect, the money's there, and it can be attached.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. McAfee.
Thank you.
Jerry Van Scoy.
Madam Chairman, I believe each of you has a copy of my testimony. Are there any questions on that? I address myself to those.
I have a question. All my tile on my floor curves upward an inch. Is that workmanlike? No, I'm very serious. I trip over it every day.
Is that workmanlike?
Yeah.
I suppose it would depend on the conditions under which the floor was put down, or who put it down, how long it's been there, and what's happened to it since it's been there.
It's been like that since a week after it was there.
You certainly would be remiss not to have contacted the contractor.
I did, and he came out and he hammered nails in it.
Hills in your tile floor. Well, I hope that I don't represent that contractor, so I won't ask his name.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Van Scoy. On 379 and 385.
Before we leave, I review that bill. I'd like to make a request.
Okay.
I'd like to have someone from the Attorney General's office appear before the committee in regard to the.
Well, we have somebody, Mr. Osborne. Do you want to come up and answer some questions?
I'm not sure that I'm familiar with the contents of this bill, Senator White.
Well, what we want to know is about the consumer
protection in regard to building construction.
I'm not familiar with what the operations of Mr. Gillette's office are in this area. I can certainly find out and advise the committee.
I'd like to know the type of complaints, what they're doing about them, because in my mind, this bill should directly pertain itself to your enforcement.
Yes.
I'd like to have your input instructed for you support the bill or what type of problems you're running into. We've had
Senate Bill 668,
Yes.
I will provide that information.
Would you have a write to us and see that each of us gets a copy? Thank you.
Well, if I might have a copy of that, Madam Chairman, would that?
John, would you send one to Dick Nostal? T.L. Johnson on 379 and 385.
Madam Chairman, members, I'm Terry L. Johnson. I'm a member of the Oregon State Board of Parole. And I'm here in a representative capacity for the board to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 379 and 385. And with me is Mr. Osborne, Solicitor General of the State of Oregon, and our legal counsel. And the board of parole does sponsor House Bill 2110, which I'm not going to testify about, but it may come into play during the testimony here today.
What's the status of that bill?
Pardon?
What is the status of that bill? Did you say 2810?
2110. I understand it passed out of the House and is on its way to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
What does it provide?
It's a bill that relates generally to parole violation procedures since the Morrissey opinion.
Was it submitted by you?
The Criminal Law Revision Commission.
Commission.
But we do support that bill. It covers the same areas as 379. I won't attempt to go through 379 section by section. I will attempt to cover certain subject areas that is covered by both bills and indicate some of the problems that the board anticipates with Senate Bill 379. But prior to doing that, I think I ought to explain our present parole violation procedures so they can be considered with regard to this bill. As the committee knows, the Morrissey opinion, which requires minimal due process standards, applies only after a person has been apprehended and is in detention related to parole violation proceeding. I think a week ago, when I was waiting to testify but did not testify, I left a report of the State Board of Parole and two sets of forms, one related to the preliminary hearing matter and the other to the parole violation proceeding. To give a brief outline of the usage of these, once a person is apprehended and detained, our hearings officer is dispatched to the site or place of detention. At that time, he uses preliminary hearing form one, and the allegations are filled in here, in particular, along with the document citing as the evidence to support the charge. The actual recommendation to revoke parole or any other report substantiating the allegations are attached to this, and it is served on the prospective alleged parole violator. Also at that time, preliminary hearing form number two is utilized, and the person in confinement status is advised of all the rights contained on this form, which would mean they're advised of the preliminary hearing, the purpose of it, that they may have legal counsel at their own expense and have an opportunity to be heard and be notified of the decision. And they can either waive their right to a formal proceeding or admit violation and waive their right.
Excuse me, John, is that right that attorney is not appointed if they're indigent?
That's correct. The Morrissey versus Brewer decision didn't pass on whether they had to have counsel. At the present time, the parole board has no authority and certainly no appropriation to pay counsel.
And the defender can't appear?
Pardon me?
The defender can't appear?
No, the public defender doesn't have, it's my understanding that the public defender is presently authorized to appear only in state post-conviction and direct criminal appeals.
Okay.
And that's the purpose of Form 2. If the person waives the right to the formal hearing without admitting violation, Form 3 is utilized. If the person admits violation in one or more respects and waives his rights, Form 4 is utilized. If he does neither and requests a hearing, Form 5 is utilized, and the time is set for the hearing. And when that time comes, the matter is heard. If the matter is waived, the hearings office proceeds immediately to hear the matter with the person at that time. If it's not waived, he sets the hearing and someone returns and conducts the hearing.
How many would you say that attorneys appear in? 1%, 10%, 50%?
We have conducted 83 on-site hearings since September 15th, and 10 have been contested hearings. And I think out of that 10, 7 have had attorneys.
Okay.
The others could not raise attorneys. Once the hearing has been concluded, the hearings officer will prepare the preliminary hearing summary or digest, which is indicated in Form 6 through Form 6C. And 6A to 6C are appropriate alternative findings depending on what the hearings officer finds. These are then transmitted to the board, and the board acts upon this administratively. And they will either order him released from custody and continued on parole under the same or different conditions, or they'll order him returned to the institution for further proceedings with regard to the parole violation matter. If the person is ordered returned, the second set of forms which relate to the parole violation hearing are utilized. They are very similar in nature and content to the first ones, except they explain the differences related to the second hearing and what may occur or may not occur. As in the first hearing, there are appropriate documents for waiver purposes, and the hearing does occur before a quorum or the entire board, and the matter is heard either on a waiver basis or with a full-scale proceeding. Form 6 here is the parole violation hearing finding conclusion order form related to contested proceedings, and Form 7 is the parole violation hearing finding conclusion and order form related to either a waived proceeding or an admitted violation and waived proceeding. That's basically how the board proceeds, just time related to the parole violators.
Jones.
Now, with regard to Senate Bill 379, the first important thing that it raises is the matter of the application of the Administrative Procedures Act to the Board of Parole. As you know, the board is presently completely exempt under the 1971 law. This purports to apply the APA to the board in both the rulemaking capacity and with regard to any act, any parole violation matters, the contested case provisions. On page 2 of the bill, at line 19, subsection 4 indicates that any actions with regard to the board related to granting or denying applications for parole are not applied in the contested case provisions. As drawn, the board does not feel, well, the board feels that is too restrictive. We feel it ought to apply, that the terminology ought to be amended to indicate in some manner or form that any action other than the parole violation proceeding does not apply to this. For example, we take actions related to restoration of good time forfeited. That's not a true grant or deny proceeding. Once a parole is ordered, there are certain things that may occur between the time of the order of parole and time of release. That's an action which we would call a rescinding action and would occur prior to the effective date of the release order. That conceivably could fall in the contested case provisions, and we don't feel it ought to fall in the contested case provisions. The difference being the matter of actual physical location and status related to the parole order. With regard to the contested case provisions of the APA, I will defer to Mr. Osborne to explain the problems raised by that matter.
Madam Chairman, member of the committee,
I think basically the Senate Bill 379 attempts to incorporate many of the provisions that the United States Supreme Court required for due process hearing in Morrissey versus Brewer. The board is presently operating under those standards now. Now, some of those standards are also incorporated in House Bill 2110. We're going to address ourselves here to the things that we're concerned about that are different, that Morrissey versus Brewer does not require, and that the legislature, if it wants to make those decisions, should make them advertently and knowing what problems we see in Senate Bill 379. Basically, I think the board's position has been that they would prefer to see this committee take action on Senate Bill, on House Bill 2110. Generally, I think the differences between standard due process of law that the courts would regard as a minimum standard and the provisions of an intricate procedural act like the Administrative Procedures Act involve questions of whether hearsay evidence can be used, that is, whether reports of various agencies can be used, whether letters, documents, that kind of thing can be put into evidence, and also on the question of judicial review of decisions by an administrative body. If this bill were enacted, both of those, the rules of evidence would be strictly followed, except for certain exceptions which are made for the benefit of the defendant in this case, and in addition to that, judicial review would be provided under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Was Morrissey a habeas corpus?
Pardon me?
Was Morrissey a habeas corpus?
Yes, it was. One of the problems with Morrissey versus Brewer is that the state of Iowa did not apparently require any hearing whatever before revocation of parole. And there were many, many cases prior to Morrissey versus Brewer on the federal level primarily, which simply said that parole is an administrative matter and that will not be reviewed by the courts except in the grossest abuse of discretion. In Oregon, we have had all along specific requirements on how you revoke parole and have provisions as to what the board must do. And how they ought to do it. But neither of the parolees in the Morrissey case got any kind of hearing whatever. So the court finally said, we're going to lay down these requirements, and they established the preliminary hearing, which is supposed to be an informal hearing conducted by somebody other than the parole officer directly in charge. And that's the occasion where the person is given a hearing before he's really plucked out of the community. It's normally at a local jail where he's arrested, and if there are witnesses in the community that he needs to have talk to the parole people, that he's able to let them know that so that you don't have him sent back to the institution and then awaiting 30 days or 60 days for a hearing, at which time he's lost his job, lost his contacts in the community, and so forth. And then the court set down certain requirements for the final hearing itself, which generally the procedures that the board has followed for many years would comply with. The principal areas in which the board's had to struggle to get in line with Morrissey versus Brewer have been in the areas of preliminary hearings and setting up the mechanics for that, trying to make those mesh into the statutes that we now have that don't really provide for them.
Who actually is the officer? I mean, is it another parole officer, or who is it?
Normally, the parole board tries to provide, it can be a supervisor, it
Someone
can be a parole board member.
Someone sent from Salem down
yes,
to here?
Yes, that will normally be the case. I think the parole board, the corrections division, which is in charge of the parole officers themselves, generally prefers to have someone who is not immediately responsible for the man or immediately responsible for the parole officer himself.
Does a defendant have written conditions of his parole?
Yes.
And can he be revoked for any reason other than those that he written condition? Well, obviously another crime, but can he be revoked for any other reasons?
Well, I think that normally not. Generally, the statute sets out the kind of basis on which the parole may be revoked. And, is that?
That's correct. The parolee can only be revoked for cause and only for violations of the conditions related to the parole order, either as standard conditions or those specially imposed by the board at the time of the parole hearing.
What is the status of the person who is cited for a parole violation from the time he's cited and until the time disposition is made?
Is he in jail?
He's in custody.
He will be in custody at some location or another.
But you don't move him back to Penn right away, then?
No.
But he is in jail at the local county sheriff's jail.
That's correct.
In other words, he's not working, he's off the job, he's not going to school or whatever.
Yeah.
That's correct.
In other words, as soon as you point him out, well, he's through in terms of his activities.
Either the corrections division or the parole board, and under our present procedures, either the parole officer who acts under corrections or the parole board itself may take action to start the proceedings to revoke his parole. And in either case, those have to be sufficiently grave to warrant arresting the man immediately, because the problem is you don't send out a 10-day letter saying we're going to revoke your parole or can hold a hearing 10 days from now or 20 days and we'll see whether you're revoked. The nature of the clientele doesn't permit that kind of procedure.
I was just thinking, the exchange of these forms, would, the mails that are today, would take almost midterm sentence.
Yes.
From it.
Yes.
So I'm trying to interpret this. When a man is cited for violation of parole, he's really just about through, isn't he? There's no chance of him picking up his old job. I'm not sure he should understand, but I just want to get the context of this in terms of time.
Once a person is cited, well, the way they're arrested, the correction division can detain them by their order temporarily for 15 days. To make investigations, and if they have reasonable cause to believe that he's violated parole. If this is done, they cannot hold him longer than 15 days unless the board acts on the matter. Or the board, by its own order, can cancel the parole and order him detained pending further proceedings. This is how this is initiated. Once that occurs, the board dispatches a hearings officer to the site. Advises the person with regard to the alleged violation, the reasons for it, and asks whether or not they want a hearing. And if they do, they set it. If they don't want a hearing, he conducts the hearing then. He then makes his report and sends it back to the board. During that period of time, the person is in confinement until the board acts upon the matter after the initial proceeding.
Well, this must be quite a lapse of time.
I have, at a random sample of 35 cases, the least period of time was 3 days, and the longest period of time was a 19-day period.
How could you deliver all these papers in 3 days?
I think they're in the alternative. You don't necessarily use all.
Well, they're taken by the hearings officer in person when he goes to the site.
Well, as I read these forms, the hearings officer comes into the picture pretty late, doesn't he? You have Form 1 and Form 2 and Form 3, and then pretty soon the hearings officer.
No, those come out of, those come from our, with our hearings officer out of Salem.
You say that ordinarily
in
about 3 days
he
he's down there, is that what you're saying?
Pardon?
Are you saying that ordinarily in about 3 days the hearings officer is down there taking the information?
Well, I'm saying the least amount of time it took was 3 days till you had a disposition by the board, either to release or return, and the longest period of time it took was 19 days.
I see.
From the initial arrest to board disposition at the
preliminary hearing. I'm glad you figured out. One more question. You asked the question, Madam Chairman, about the hearing officer, and I'm not sure, Did you say that ordinarily your hearing officers are people from the corrections department?
No, I didn't say that.
Now, would you tell me who they are? Are they the regular hearings officers that hear all others? The hearings officers are provided by the state for various things from the Administrative Procedures Act.
We have a man who has been our administrative assistant, so to speak, since July 1st, 1969. He's informally loaned to the board to help them conduct their business. He is the man who conducts the hearings and acts as hearings officer, or individual members themselves do. And I've conducted approximately 18 or 20 of these hearings myself. We have Representative Martin has submitted House Bill 2660, which requests two executive assistants be attached to the parole board and one secretary to support them in order to do this function.
These people have any special training? I'm familiar with some of the hearings conducted by, I remember going to one by Mr. Brown from the State Board of Higher Education. I thought he was a very skilled hearing officer. I don't know what his name, I don't think he was a lawyer.
At this point, no, they do not. With the exception of myself, and I happen to be a member of the bar. But if House Bill 2660 goes through, we would anticipate consulting the Attorney General's office and having them with the parole board develop procedures to be followed in order that we could indicate to the hearings officers the correct procedure to be followed.
You are on the board, Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
Are there any other attorneys?
No.
Would there be any advantage to having a person who was not direct connected with the corrections system, but a professional hearing officer like some of the others I've mentioned?
Well, the board
hearing officers are all trained within their departments. There aren't hearings officers for the government in general. If you're with Workman's Comp, you're with Workman's Comp.
This man that I heard was a Mr. Brown, and he was hearing a case against the State Board of Higher Education. I know they don't have any hearing officers.
Well,
so I don't know where he came from, maybe from State Industrial Act or something. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any answer to his question?
Well, the board's of the opinion that it would be better to have an independent hearings officer attached to the board or from outside of the corrections division to conduct these hearings, because you sever all ties of any possible overreaching or influence.
If he was attached to the corrections department, though, he really would have ties, wouldn't he?
Pardon?
If he were attached, you spoke about Representative Martin's bill. If he was attached to the corrections department, then he would develop ties, would he not? Well, it couldn't help it. I mean, just like you and I, if we went fishing together, we'd...
Well, our assumption is that would occur, yes. And that's why we're asking that two hearings officers be attached to the parole board, as opposed to the field supervisory staff of the correction division.
I think his point is, wouldn't he be influenced in favor of the parole officer's revocation by means of the fact that he's employed by the corrections department, the hearing officer?
That's very possible, Senator.
Thank you.
Bob?
We did have a couple of other observations. One of the things that we're specifically concerned about with Senate Bill 379 is the provision that the parolee receives advance notice of the
page and
revocation.
What page?
Section 4.
Section begins in Section 4.
Line 17, page 3.
The State Board of Parole and Probation or parole officer shall notify a parolee of parole revocation by means of a written notice containing the following information. And Section 5, starting at line 34, not less than 5 days, not more than 10 days after the parolee has been notified, a preliminary hearing shall be held. And
Section 14.
The provisions for detaining the defendant And section 14, page 6, says any time after the notice has been sent to the parolee is provided in section 4. The State Board of Parole and Probation or a parole officer may cause the parolee to be detained if there exists reasonable grounds to believe he will not appear. I'm not speaking personally, but I think it would be probably the observation of the parole department that hearings might be difficult to hold if the parolee has advance notice that the hearing is going to take place.
Well, as I understand it, the governor set up Kathleen Beaufay and Judge Branchfield and Bob Oliver to set up an informal procedure. Is that
now this pertains to the corrections division and the hearings at the
This is within the institution?
Yes.
Oh, I see. All right.
There is not a similar review with respect to matters of parole.
Okay.
Excuse me. Now, how did that happen? Parole is part of the corrections division. When they developed this limited application of the Administrative Procedures Act to the corrections people, how did you folks get left out?
The reason is because there is a specific exemption in the Administrative Procedures Act exempting parole board, but not exempting corrections division.
I didn't know that. No.
And there is legislation both before your committee and before another committee dealing with the problems of corrections division and the APA as well as these problems. The Senate Bill 379 provides throughout that the parolee is to be notified of his right to the assistance of counsel or counsel substitute at the preliminary hearing. Now, the court in Morrissey v. Brewer was very careful not to decide the question of whether or not a parolee ought to be entitled to the aid of a lawyer. There are those who say that if any lawyer is allowed in a parole hearing, then equal protection of the laws would require that those who are unable to afford counsel should have counsel appointed for them. Some states have solved this problem in their own way by saying nobody can have a lawyer in a parole hearing. Try to solve the equal protection problem by saying no lawyers at all. The alternative is to proceed having lawyers in those cases in which the assistance of counsel happens to occur, and the legislature may want to consider whether or not counsel should be provided to persons who are subject to parole revocation. The difficulty, of course, is a matter of finances.
Mr. Johnson, when you conduct a hearing, do you find it helpful or not helpful to have counsel present?
Depends on how complicated the case is. And on occasion, I have found it very helpful to have counsel present because counsel can get the issues defined, and the alleged parole violator tends to be over emotional and expand the matters and get into many irrelevant things. And rather than that approach, counsel can get it limited to the right perspective and oftentimes present useful matters, and he can present a well-oriented case, so it keeps everyone in the on track, so to speak. In cases which are not too complicated, I don't think it makes much difference then.
I'm sure.
Senator Smith.
Are you supporting Section 15 of the bill? Section 16, pardon me.
No, Senator, we're not supporting Section 16.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to be sitting on this. I've attended your parole hearings and I'm much impressed, but I really don't know what the legal status is of a person on parole. Is this a kind of a privilege under the law, or does he change his status when he goes out, out on parole? He has something there. It's a privilege, I know, but is it something more than that that can be protected by law?
Well, there's an attorney general opinion which indicates, and I can't remember when it was issued, that parole as a matter of status is a continuation of the sentence. Up until the Morrissey opinion, many boards operate on this theory of privilege versus right. Morrissey seems to indicate that being out of the institution as opposed to within the confinements of the institution is a substantial interest to be protected, and they get away from the privilege versus right theory, if I understood that correctly.
Yes.
But that would mean then work release or almost anything else, so home visits? How would you draw the line?
That's a line that's very difficult to draw, and we have many cases filed in habeas corpus challenging treatment at the institution because a man doesn't have a Xerox machine or doesn't have this or that, different changes in status. Normally, where there's a status change within the institution itself, such as a man being placed on work release and having that revoked, that's considered sufficiently significant that he is given a hearing. It isn't just because it makes a substantial difference to the man. In some cases, institutional transfers, there's been a lot of talk about whether where a man's transferred from one institution, whether or not he ought to have the right to hearing. Everybody's recognized, I think, and the Supreme Court has, that being on parole has such a significance to the man that it is subject to constitutional protection.
Was this the United States Supreme Court decision?
Yes.
Section 9 of the bill provides something that when I was taking criminal defense work, I wish we'd had. That is, the bill provides that parolees without funds to retain counsel needs to be paid a reasonable fee by the Board of Parole. Certainly substantially better treatment than is afforded a person charged with a crime. Should the commission or should the legislature determine that counsel should be appointed, I'm somewhat of a loss as to how that's to be done. I don't know whether the parole board presently doesn't have any authority to do that. Normally, of course, counsel is appointed by a court, and normally you don't appoint counsel to represent someone. In the case of a state agency, to represent one appearing before you, it may be that the proponents of the bill would want to refine this a little bit. One, to provide an appropriation to pay it. Two, to determine how the board, whether it's the board that's to appoint counsel, and three, to determine some sort of a fee schedule. Then, of course, as we've indicated, the other thing which 379 does is to provide for judicial review of decisions made by the parole board. I'm not sure just why it's felt this is necessary. Apparently, there must be some feeling that there are people whose parole is being revoked that they shouldn't have revoked. I assume that normally where solution is offered, there's a problem that goes around to meet it, but I couldn't speak to that here. The present standard has been whether the board has exercised its authority arbitrarily. The new standard that would be imposed in Section 11 is something like a 50-50 chance. If there's a greater likelihood the parolee will be rehabilitated, if parole were revoked, then if not, then the board can proceed to revoke him. If they decide that the chances are less than 50-50, then they're not supposed to revoke him. I don't know whether that's an appropriate standard for parole or parole revocation or not, nor do I fully appreciate what the test of substantial evidence would be in getting into court appeal.
If you come up here, we can vote this bill out. Yeah, right.
You've been named every other committee. You might as well join us.
then finally, this may perhaps be a small point. Section 8, subsection 9 provides that the parolees to be informed of the penalties for failure to attend the revocation hearing, and no penalties are provided. I think that concludes my discussion.
I'd like to make a couple comments, if I might.
Let me through in a minute. Questions? Thank you very much.
May I make a couple comments before done this? With regard to the matter of counsel, the board procedure and policy is to allow retained counsel. On page 5, line 27. And on page 3, line 31, which relates to assistance of counsel or counsel, substitute and preliminary and parole violation procedures. We do not object to counsel or any person who is authorized to practice law under the Supreme Court state rules of this state.
Do you ever get any legal aid?
Yes, on occasion legal aid offices represent persons in this position. We do object to counsel substitute because it expands that to conceivably close relatives, other alleged parole violators, people who are directly interested in the case and emotionally, and these hearings do become emotionally charged because of the interest to be preserved. We do not feel that if that provision is utilized, we can conduct orderly proceedings, and therefore we'd limit that. Not sure. With regard to section 5 of this bill, it indicates a preliminary hearing should occur within 48 hours. We feel that instead of a specific time period of that effect, it should be a reasonable time, and we would propose that section similar to section 12 of House Bill 2110 ought to be substituted. With regard to the conduct of the hearing, there's a provision in this bill that indicates in section 10, page 6, line 1, requires that the hearing be conducted before the entire board. We feel it ought to be a quorum as opposed to the entire membership sitting on the matter. With regard to the site, we feel the site ought not to be limited to the county, but should be either at or near the place of the alleged violation or place of confinement as indicated in Morrissey, in order that we have flexibility. We're opposed to serving in writing the hearings officer's recommendation upon the person. In actual practice, the hearings officer notifies them orally at that time. One problem here is the county sheriff often transport him between counties for other reasons, and we do not know how long the person is going to be at the site he's at that time, and it's completely at the hands of the county sheriff. With regard to section 7, it indicates that a revocation hearing shall be held within 30 days after the hearings officer decision on the preliminary hearing, or within 30 days after date of the parolee's waiver. and provides for extension of time under certain circumstances. The board would suggest that if that section is retained, that the parole violation be required to be held within a reasonable time after return to the institution or within 30 or 60 days after return. The same matter applies here, and the county sheriffs actually have responsibility for the movement of the people. They may have them held on pending charges in the county. They may not, due to their manpower problem, immediately return them to the institution. We never know when they're going to come back. When they are returned, we're then notified. We're then in a position to proceed, but we're not until we know the location. And the board, under its operating procedure, if it had to conduct the preliminary, the parole violation proceeding when the man was still on site, you'd have to send the quorum of your board to the site to comply with this provision in many cases. I would like to say one word about the standards for revocation imposed by this bill. It would be the position of the board that if this is to be the criteria, it is insufficient as specifying a standard for revocation. We would suggest that if there should be a standard imposed related to revocation actions, then we'd suggest the following amendment, something to this effect. Whenever the State Board of Parole and Probation considers an alleged parole violator and finds such person has violated one or more conditions of parole, the board shall not reinstate parole status when it finds, one, the circumstances offered in mitigation in regard to the violation found to exist does not warrant reinstatement, and or there is a reasonable probability the parole violator will not, if reinstated, remain outside the institution without violating the law, and that his release is incompatible with the welfare of society, or three, there is substantial risk he will not conform to the conditions of parole, or four, his reinstatement at that time would depreciate the seriousness of the parole violation or promote disrespect for law, or five, reinstatement would have a substantially adverse effect upon other persons on active parole status with regard to their attitude towards supervision under parole, or six, the parole violator's recommitment and continued correctional treatment, medical care, vocational or other training in the institution will substantially enhance his capacity to lead a law-abiding life when released at a later date. The reason for the proposed amendment, we are then in the position we were initially in on the initial parole hearing matter. The standard should be equated to that. And the final problem with regard to this, there is no limiting effect of this bill with regard to where and under what circumstances the alleged parole violator is detained or located. We would therefore propose that a section similar to Section 15 and 16 of House Bill 2110 be added to this bill. And the problem there is, if a parole violator is located out of state, there's difficulty in complying with on-site procedures, or if he's located in another federal or state institution, there's difficulty there. These sections would indicate that in that kind of situation, and where we cannot comply with an on-site hearing out of the state of Oregon or out of the jurisdiction to which he was paroled, that the person ought to be directly returned to Oregon and then all matters taken up at that time. I believe I don't have any other comments on this bill.
Madam Chairman.
Senator White.
Sir, do I understand you to say that you support House Bill 2110 as it came out of the House?
That's correct.
And this would then be in lieu of or substitute for 385 and 379, is that correct?
Well, I'm not sure House Bill 2110 covers exactly the same things that are in 385. It does in part, but it does cover the matters that are presented in 379.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Judge Branchfield, I think we'll discuss that bill on Wednesday, if that's all right with you.
I said I'll be available to everyone, Madam Chairman.
Right, let's put that on Wednesday. That land court bill.
I've not directly testified to Senate Bill 385, but I can prepare a written statement and send it to you in lieu of testifying now.
If you would, please. We appreciate that. Meeting's adjourned.